Franklin County Board of Equalization, September 19th, 2019. Franklin County Board of Equalization meeting, September 19th, 2019. Okay, so we can go ahead and get started. Welcome to today's Board of Equalization meeting. Today is September 19th, 2019. I just wanted to kind of do a formal introduction of everybody here today. We have our newest board member, Gregory Garcia. Welcome, this first year. Alicia Greenaway has been on the board since 2010, so she's our veteran. And then Joe Chris, this is your second year with us, so welcome back. And then myself, Amanda Pearson, my first year here at the county and on the board. So that's the first. We have Peter McInderker, who is our assessor this year, celebrating your 20th year in the assessor's office. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And then Nikki Morgan, who's our chief appraiser. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we'll just jump right into it here. We'll go ahead and give you the board members the oath of office. So I'll go ahead and start with that. Do you solemnly swear that you will perform your duties as members of the Franklin County Board of Equalization in a fair and impartial manner?
I do.
Alrighty. So, and then we will go ahead and kind of discuss it already a little bit, but we'll go ahead and select a chairman. So who would you guys choose for your chairman this year?
We choose Alicia Greenaway.
Okay. Gregor, are you okay with that as well?
Pardon me?
Are you okay with selecting Alicia as chairman for the year?
Perfect.
Alrighty, and then we can just go ahead and jump right into your guys' update.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you all for being willing to share your time and your talent with us here at Franklin County as being members of the Board of Equalization. It is a critically important process that you're involved in, and on behalf of the office and the county, I thank you for your service. As Amanda said, it's my 20th year in the office, my first year as assessor. We have not got close to critical mass at any point yet thus far, so things have been going along well, and a lot of that is due to the prior assessor, Mr. Marks, and all the things that he imparted on me, but also left with the office. His mentorship is very visible in the office. So we've got a brief presentation today about the revaluation area and our statistical update this year to the values in Franklin County. We'll talk about the market conditions, and kind of go through some basics of valuation again for you as a refresher. We do have a plethora of different types of cases this year. We have residential, we have commercial. I don't think we have any ag at this point. We have a couple of industrial properties that are under appeal as well. So we will try and disseminate our information to you as well as to the appellant in a clear and concise manner that you can render a decision in a fair and just manner. So at this point, I think I would like to turn it over to Nikki Morgan, my chief appraiser, to introduce the appraisal staff. Nikki has been with us 5 years, 4 years. Came over from Benton County, was the residential supervisor over there, and took my position when I moved up into assessor. I will let her introduce the staff, and we can kind of get going into the presentation about reevaluation.
Okay, so Brian Moneymaker is one of our appraisers. He specializes in all things agricultural. He also assists with commercial and residential and everything else in between. He's also been here for almost 5 years. Monica Crutchfield is her first year that she'll be starting to defend values, as well as Marina Denisuk. So, and then Fenny Ho has been with us for almost 4 years, five?
Four.
4 years. So that's our staff, and they work very hard. Even though Monica and Marina is their first year, they hit the ground running. They each had their entire inspection area that they fielded with assistance and have spoken to many taxpayers on, so they already have a ton of experience under their belt. Thanks, guys.
How's your baby?
Yeah.
Excellent. You're welcome.
He's almost a year.
Oh, my.
That's right. I remember.
Already?
Don't ask to see pictures.
Oh, do it. I know. Do it. But if you need to bring them, it's okay.
Yeah, November. Yeah, coming up on a big day.
Just a side note, both Monica and Marina are not accredited at this point.
Okay.
You cannot get accreditation until you have a year worth of experience, an ethics class, which both of them have passed,
okay,
and then a basic appraisal course, which they will be attending in the middle of next month. So once they're done with those three things, they'll be fully accredited with the state of Washington. So we're still mentoring them and working with them.
So that's when they can start
working independently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they'll be really defending their appraisals.
Yeah, and so what happens in that case, if they're not accredited, somebody else is vouching for that work that is accredited.
Okay, so they'll be double-checking following through.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, like we work with them through the fall, through the valuation process.
So they'll be sitting on the stand during the hearings, but someone else will be presenting the information so that they can be there to answer any questions because they also were there and worked through the valuation process, but they weren't necessarily responsible for their work yet.
Okay.
And much like Finney in the first couple years of her employment here, too, they will be coming in, sitting in and on different hearings to see how they go and to kind of get up how that process works and that kind of.
So, Peter,
yes.
Your staffing levels right now, are you fully staffed? Or
are we are fully staffed. We had a retirement a year ago July, and so we had an opening that we were getting ready to fill there, and then with Steve's retirement, we knew we were going to have another opening as well, and we were able to, with hiring two people, we had enough in the budget that we could hire them both in October and get them started together, and that kind of gave us a leg up. Are we fully staffed? I'm fully staffed to the budgetary level I'm given at this point. As with last year, requesting another appraiser, we'll go through that budgetary process with the commissioners to see if that's financially attainable.
Okay, so starting in on the presentation,
yeah,
you have a paper copy, and this is our slides if you want to look up here. So our inspection area was everything just outside of the east side of Pasco, out past the highway there, and then out the Pasco-Colotus Highway all the way out to Colotus and the edge of the county on the northern and side border there. So that is the inspection area. So every parcel was inspected by an appraiser, lots of drive time. Parcel count maybe a little fewer than the more densely populated residential areas, but a lot more drive time to those inspections.
And that area also includes what we call the outside towns. So Connell, Basin City, Colotus, Altopia, Mesa. So
a big area.
Great. So revaluation notices were mailed out on August 2nd. So the last day to appeal would have been September 2nd, but that was the holiday, so September 3rd. There were 28,933 parcels that received revaluation notices from us. So out of 32,000 approximate taxable parcels, almost 29 received change of value notices.
And we don't mail to exempt.
Right.
So you take the exempt off the top of the 32,000, so we're changing value on a lot of them. most of the universe of parcels?
4,290 parcels were in the inspection area, and on an average, there was 15.63% appreciation. So that's before new construction. That was just at the end of revaluation. Changes made in correcting condition and picking up buildings that we may not have received a permit for in the inspection area. So appreciated on average 15.63%. So you'll kind of see the breakdown of where, which areas received most of that. There was 21,483 parcels with less than 15% appreciation, or 74.25%. So three quarters of those received less than 15% increase before new construction. 2,987 parcels, the appreciation was between 16 and 30%, so about 10% in that mid-range. And then there were 1,466 parcels with appreciation that was greater than 30, or 5%. And then at the end there were almost 3,000 parcels where the value went down. So 10% saw a decrease in their assessed value after inspection and revaluation.
So 28,900 parcels, that's the entire county?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Almost. The 28,900, those are the parcels that received a revaluation notice. So if their value didn't change at all, it's a very small population of parcels.
Yeah.
Almost the whole county received value notices from us.
Save the postage.
Right.
So the 4,290 parcels, those are the ones basically eyeballs on, more detail.
Okay. Right. That mm-hmm. green area on the previous
So this
page.
Green area represents that?
Yes.
Okay.
And so just for background, mm-hmm. every 6 years we do a revaluation plan with the Department of Revenue. And they look at the number of parcels, the number of improved parcels, the types of improvements that are on those parcels, the uses. And they like to see, it's a systematic approach, but they also like to see balance in those areas.
Sure.
So this was the last year of our six-year plan, and we've redone that plan, and now we'll be moving into our next six-year plan and to balance some of this out. And this is one of the areas where we have probably the lightest amount of improved parcels, but we have the most travel and logistical issues with.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's...
time on the road is
mm-hmm,
kind of the
mm-hmm.
balancing factor.
And then we take all of that information, we submit it to the Department of Revenue, and they approve or they suggest changes to that plan, and then we move forward with that. So
you've gotten the approval back?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, so in 6 years when you see our inspection area map for this area, the lines will be slightly different. Okay. Just try to keep that balance.
Does your plan get, do you issue revisions to it on an annual basis, or is it
you
just
can.
Once?
Typically, we don't. We have done things in the past, like we have done, we have changed our inspection cycle order based upon, okay, we were going to do this area in West mm-hmm. Pasco last year, but we have more concerns with our data out in the irrigation block, so we're going to switch those so we can get our data cleaned up first and statistically adjust the other one where we have more confidence in our model.
Okay.
So we've done that, and you have anything like that, you have to get approval from the department.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so in the inspection area, the revaluation areas of study. So as you mentioned, all the outside towns, Connell, Colotus, Mesa, Eltopia, and the outskirts of Pasco near the PK Highway, PK Road. So appreciation rates in the reval area without new construction split by the residential, agricultural, and commercial. So residential saw an average of 33%. Rural, residential, and agricultural saw 46%. And commercial in the inspection area saw an 81% increase. And that is, as I have spent multiple hours explaining to taxpayers with questions, that does not mean that their market increased 81% in 1 year or in 6 years. It just means upon a whole new appraisal, quite possibly we were undervalued before.
Sure.
So rather than looking at percentage of increase, we have to talk about what the property is worth, but that is a lot to ingest in 1 year.
I'm sure they had a lot of phone calls.
Not as many as I expected.
Only 39 appeals.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the agricultural properties, the market value of irrigated farm ground remained unchanged. The current use values decreased, and there are a couple factors that played into that, but one of the main ones was interest rates. So it looks at an average of the last 5 years for that cap rate. And the permanent crop values, the orchard and vineyard, they were unchanged, but we did mail out the surveys to all parcel owners with permanent crops, and we how many did we receive back? 75%?
Almost 80.
Almost 80% we received back.
Oh, wonderful.
So that's an updated change on the types of crops that are there, their age, and of course, acreage breakdown of the different crops. So we can update our
records. That's more than I thought you would.
Right.
So, nice. So does somebody have to enter that all into a computer so you can do some analysis?
Yeah, at the beginning, that was bad. Yeah. Nice. All right, Steve used to do that. Now I've got to. Yeah.
Okay.
No, we plug it all in. And I think some of our response has been that we've systematically have been doing this. So you get that conditioned response that they're going to turn it in. I think the other thing is, too, growers understand as well that when you have newer crops, they don't produce in the first 3 to 5 years, so their value is lesser. And so sometimes it's to their benefit to let us know. The other thing is, too, it just makes their record keeping that much easier when we can talk back and forth about things. And if they make changes, a lot of them are getting to the point, okay, we've made changes to our orchard again. We need to let the assessor know, you know, which is very beneficial, and it helps as well with our analysis. One thing I would say about, just so Mr. Gregory understands, do you understand what current use is? Current use is a separate valuation other than market value that is given to agricultural properties to keep them in agricultural production. It is only applied to the land. So we carry two, if you have a farm, we carry two values. One will be market value and one is current use. Current use is what they pay taxes on. One of the reasons we didn't change the market value of irrigated ground was we have sales that indicate market value is going up, but our current use calculation indicates that the rents being received to the owner are going down. And so that's kind of inverse of what you would think. You know, if your property's worth more, it should rent for more. So we're looking at that. We're going to, and the permanent crops we're going to study this year as well.
So. In addition to those changes, we updated to our most recent Marshall and Swift cost tables. So what that means is all of our values for improvements start with the cost basis according to Marshall and Swift. And if it's been a few years since those have been updated, Marshall and Swift updates every month, but those updates don't go live into our system right away. They're held partially by our software company and partially by us until we're ready to change a bunch of values according to cost. So we did update to all new Marshall and Swift cost tables and the local multipliers. So what that means is Marshall and Swift's a national database, and they give us local multipliers to put on those numbers to make it more accurate for our specific market. So all of those numbers were updated.
Do you, Nikki, do any sort of correlation with the other counties, the other assessors, to value, like at least in the Tri-Cities, I guess it would be Benton, as far as do you kind of in the same ballpark when you look at things? I don't know how you would do that comparison. I mean, like, you guys don't look at them and say, those guys are so low. Or they say they're so high. I was just wondering.
Yeah.
So we, every year the Department of Revenue does a ratio study on our sales, and they determine our level of assessment. And there is every ratio study that they've done for probably the last 15, 20 years is out on their website.
Right.
And it shows every county's level of assessment on real and personal property. We try and work with the other counties on sharing data. We have the Assessors Association has developed a statewide commercial database for sales that hopefully we'll be able to use to give us a little better idea on some of the comps that are available. But it's one of those things, the results will be determined by the level of participation by the counties that are involved. So if people feed the database, we'll have more resources. If we don't, we'll have less.
You reminded me about the review of the state.
Yeah, our level of assessment last year in the county was 95%. In Benton County, it was about 84, I believe, 82. So, it's hard in a market like this where it is really the Tri-Cities market. But we don't have access to their data over there. So,
okay. So the statewide commercial sales database, is that optional?
Yes.
It is optional.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts about?
Oh, I think
turning the screws and making it just to make the state a little bit more.
I don't. The database was developed by the Assessors Association. It's been facilitated by the Department of Revenue through their IT department.
Okay.
Participation or the teeth would have to come through the Assessors Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that people want to see. Hey, are they going to be able to get this done and get it up and running and then participate in it? And I think now that it's up and going, I think the participation will increase.
Okay. Okay.
That's my hope.
The only other way that they could pressure counties to do it is through legislation, which is probably not likely because it doesn't directly impact values or monitor values.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Sure. So after all of that, post-revaluation, sales since the end of 2018, so looking at 2019 sales, which we do monthly, reflecting continued appreciation in the local market. Limited supply and increased demand are causing an increase in real estate values. So we have been talking about that year after year, and I think we were all shocked to see that not only is it continued, but it's increasing. And
especially land. Bare land, developable land. The prices people are paying for land out in West Pasco is astonishing.
Obscene.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... Well, sometimes it's scary when we look at the sales and look at what's going on, how much appreciation there is. And seeing what we've had happen in the past nationally because of rapid appreciation, it does kind of give us a moment of pause, you know. We don't, but the market is what it is. So.
So that was a brief look at our revaluation and inspection area. So looking outside of that area, the statistical adjustment, residential appreciation rate, so again without new construction. West Pasco was 17%, Central Pasco 8%, and East Pasco 14%. So rural residential under 30 acres saw an increase of 8% overall. So again, still a pretty significant increase.
So Central Pasco is considered what? Like, is that like between 395 and?
So Central Pasco, I would say, is the one what we would call our 100 area, which would go from Road 48 over to Road 14th Avenue.
14th Avenue. Okay.
Mm-hmm. South of the freeway.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And part of those lines are going to move. When we institute our plan.
Okay.
So we've had so much growth in some areas that we had to shift lines to balance stuff out, and mm-hmm. one of the areas is going to be out in the Riverview area. That 100 area is going to get bigger and the 200 area is going to get smaller. Mm. So, yeah.
Okay. So looking at commercial, that was residential. Looking at commercial, the Road 68 corridor was an average of 16% increase. West Pasco, 5%. Central Pasco 3, and then since we were just in the East Pasco area, it was unchanged. That they didn't see a statistical update. Okay. So we were talking before our level of assessment. So that's the ratio study that we do work through with the Department of Revenue. So it's our assessment divided by the sales price, which gives you the percentage. So Washington state law requires us to attempt to be at 100% of fair market value. And then this is a looking back on all of those revaluation notices that we mailed out of sales that occurred in 2018, more specifically May of 18 through May of 19, right?
Mm-hmm.
Residentially, we were at 95.4%, commercially 93%, and agricultural 79.1%.
Well, we were up from last year, so that's better.
Again, post-revaluation sales are reflecting a continued appreciation. So, in the inspection area, out of the inspection area, rural, agricultural, you name it, it's all seen an increase.
Yeah, and some property types are more than others. Multifamily are very strong right now. With the limited rental market, incomes are up, cap rates are down, so, and land. Land is the what do they say? They're not making any more of it, and it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
When you say cap rates are down, you're referring to?
So the interest rate we use on the income approach.
Okay.
So the less risk you're willing to take on, the lower the cap rate will be.
Mm-hmm.
So incomes get up, values increase, there's less risk, the cap rate's going to go down.
Okay.
And we'll go through that process.
So a little bit of information, our website, of course, if you need to look anything up, and it's available to all of our taxpayers as well. All property characteristics are available online, as well as sales information. The statistics, overall the statistics for each individual, what we call neighborhood. So maybe not every subdivision is its own neighborhood, but there's a brief description of that, and then the statistics and sales for all of those areas. Various ways to search for information are available, whether it be sales or information on specific properties. We don't put parcel calculations out on the website as far as our exact cost approach. They're just looking at their overall improvement value and their land value. Just a brief look at one of our
our favorite
repeat
customers.
Visitors, yes, Pasco Associates, which are the owners of the Yokes and the pad site there on Road 68. They have appealed every year, including this one, those two parcels. And their 2018 BTA case was withdrawn by them after the BTA ruled in favor of the assessor's value for the 2015, 16, and 17 years.
Oh.
That said, they have still appealed their values this year through the Board of Equalization. So.
We had another case, I believe it was Pasco Lodging as well, that you heard and upheld. That was appealed to the State Board of Equalization, or Board of Tax Appeals, and during that interim period, waiting for the scheduling of the hearing, the property sold for more than what we had assessed that.
Oh.
So that went away.
I'm so,
so
shocked.
No, they haven't withdrawn.
Oh, they haven't
it's
withdrawn.
Still waiting for scheduling.
We feel pretty comfortable on that one.
Yeah.
Did anything else go to the state?
Yes, we have Mrs. Wells. Is pending
okay.
Up near Basin City, as well as Connell LLC, which is the multifamily property in Connell with the 25 units
okay.
that
oh, yeah.
is under appeal again, which is typical when you have a property that is under appeal with the state, they will appeal again the next subsequent years until
right.
they get a decision from the state to a to
right.
protect the right of appeal each year.
Right.
Because
right.
just like with your decisions, they're 1 year only.
Right.
Same with the state. So, yeah. I believe that's all we have with this state.
We had one for American Leasing, the rock company that was the concrete company that's changed ownership since then. And that one was heard last month, but no decision has been made.
Oh, okay.
The only difference with the Connell property is that's a formal appeal, which we have never done. So, and that's in Superior Court. So, it will be a learning process.
So who represents the assessor?
The county.
Okay.
Yeah, we have counsel through the county.
Okay.
The county has to defend the elected. So, it's one of those things where we are, so far it's been more of the participation by the prosecuting attorney's office is more legal advice and opinion or process. We're still providing all the appraisal information, that kind of thing.
And why did it go?
That is the appellant's choice.
And they're represented by an attorney who's doing all their paperwork, so I think it was the natural route for them that they thought that they needed to take as an attorney.
Interesting. Okay.
That's their comfort zone.
Oh.
Okay. Well, and my understanding is the property owner is a sitting judge.
So, oh. Okay, then.
So it makes more sense.
Okay.
It's playing
in that's, the, yeah, that's probably the venue they're most comfortable with.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
We want to play in his pool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Her pool.
Her right. pool. Okay.
Either way.
Her pool. Okay.
So a little bit about our methodology, appraisal methodology. We do follow the three approaches to value, cost, sales comparison, and income. Mm-hmm. So residential and agricultural properties are valued using the cost model. And then that is adjusted using sales. So it's calibrated to the market, calibrated cost approach. For commercial and multifamily parcels, the income approach may also be utilized, and that's what we switched to a couple years back. Mm-hmm. So looking a little deeper into the income approach, it is the conversion of a property's income stream into an estimate of value. The data required would be what we like to refer to as IRV. It's the income of the property for the year, the rate, which is the cap rate, and then the value, which could be, depending on which two you have, you can find the third. So the income is net operating income for that year, and the value could be the sales price or our estimate of value. So there's how the formula works. It's just a triangle. So if you have two, you can find the third. The income approach is a real estate appraisal method that allows investors to estimate the value of a property by taking the net operating income of the rent collected and dividing that by the capitalization rate to find the value. And then you can work that backwards, of course. If you have one and a sales price, you could work it the other way. So when we look at net operating income, we do look at it a little bit differently than business owners or investors do. The NOI is simply the annual income generated by an income-producing property after taking into account all income collected from operations and deducting the allowable expenses incurred from operations. So in what we do, there are what we refer to as proper expenses, things that we are allowed to deduct, management, insurance, utilities, maintenance, wages and benefits of employees for the income-producing property. There are some miscellaneous expenses which we allow, and then reserves for replacement, so repairing and fixing the actual real estate, the building itself. Mm-hmm. Improper expenses, which sometimes we have to explain to the appellants, is depreciation on the real estate, debt services, the owner's personal investment into the property, capital improvements, franchise fees, and the big one, real estate taxes. So we do not include real estate taxes as an allowable expense because we then load the cap rate with the local tax rate at the end. So a real quick look on why we do that. Let's just say our assessed value was completely wrong or based off of, we don't want it to affect our next year's appraisal. So if you're looking at the amount of taxes as an expense and that's affecting your new value, we're basing our new value on our old value, which we don't want to do. So in order to remove it from the equation, we don't deduct taxes as an expense, but we use the local tax rate that they're going to pay in taxes on the cap rate. So we're removing our own work from the decision of value so that we're not affecting the decision in any way.
We reflect the property taxes and the cap rate instead of the expenses.
Right. So an example of an income approach, you have parcel A and parcel B. Parcel A's sale price was $1 million. and their income that year was $100,000, their cap rate would be 10%, which is just the rate equals income over sales price. So that's an example of how ERB works to find the rate. Parcel B, if we have a cap rate and we have their income for the year, we can arrive at an estimated value using the two that we have. So there are multiple ways that we arrive at cap rates and find values on certain properties and then find values on certain properties using cap rates from others. Any questions on that?
So the I assume there's some limitations to geography that would affect the cap rate. Obviously, Road 68 has a much, I would think, has a higher cap rate than perhaps somewhere else.
Sure, geography has a lot to do with it, but it's also comparable property. So an apartment complex in Richland may be very comparable to an apartment complex in Pasco. It depends on all of the economics of the property itself. Is it comparable?
Okay.
And I would say differences in cap rates sometimes are due to difference in property types.
All right.
So if you have a more risky property type, you're going to want a higher rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
So,
many warehouses.
Yeah, something that has good stable income is going to have probably a lower cap rate.
Okay. All right.
So this is a little bit on deed types, and this is important because when we talk about comparable sales or our level of assessment using sales, we're only talking about valid arm's length transactions and on market value. So some of the deeds that we do not consider, if a property was transferred on a quitclaim deed, we don't consider it a valid sale. That's a form of conveyance in which any interest the grantor possesses in the property described in the deed is conveyed to the grantee without any warranty of title.
Do we have any of these this year?
Quitclaim deeds?
Yeah.
We have them all the time.
Yeah, every day, every week, there are quitclaim deeds. So those sales are invalidated. They're not used in our sales pools as comparables.
Okay.
Because it wasn't a clear title when they transferred the property.
Good example is Alicia owns a piece of commercial real estate, and then she forms an LLC.
Right.
You deed your personal interest into the LLC.
Oh, right.
It's not a market transaction. It's just a deed of your interest.
Right.
Or if we're you have a property and Nikki owns the business, I own the building, I give her half the building, she gives me half the business.
Right.
That would the real estate part of that would be a quick claim.
No, I'd say, do we have any of those this year, like trying to get out of paying their taxes? I hate those when they come up and try to do
I don't think so.
Oh, good.
I don't think
Thank
so.
Goodness.
No.
Because they're trying to argue the point. It's like, oh, shut up.
Right.
Yeah.
No, every once in a while an appellant will use a sale that they think is a valid market sale, and it just
right.
happens to be the low one that they want to use, and we'll have to point out that no,
that
it was transferred on a quitclaim deed. It wasn't in our sales.
Not a market sale.
I would say this, that over the course of the past few years, we have really put an emphasis on trying to verify the sales much more thoroughly than we used to. Some of that is just having the time and the manpower to do it, but also being able to identify the sales that really need to be investigated, instead of trying to investigate everything.
Yeah.
You know. So.
So then there's your basic warranty deed or statutory warranty deeds. These are usually the deeds that we put in our sales pool. They convey to the grantee title to the property free and clear of all encumbrances, except those specifically set forth in the document. So these went through a title company. The title was clear when they transferred ownership. Your basic market sales are typically on these two types of deeds. You also have a bargain and sale deed, which conveys the real property from a seller to a buyer, but does not guarantee clear title. It's also used by court officials and fiduciaries to convey property that they hold by force of law, so foreclosure.
Another deed that you'll see is sometimes called a personal representative deed, and that's typically an estate purpose that is used. And what happens is when the court appoints a personal representative for an estate, and it sells property, they do it with the personal representative's deed. And the personal representative deed guarantees the clear title from the time they were appointed as the representative of the estate till the time it sells, but nothing before. So it's a very limited guarantee of clear title, and those we disqualify. And they're, most of the time I've seen those on, it's on estate purposes only.
Another form of what we consider a valid market transaction could be conveyed on a real estate contract. So that's a contract between parties for the purchase and sale, exchange, of conveyance of real estate. So those occur all the time as well. A trust deed is a deed that establishes a trust. So it's an instrument that conveys legal title to a property to a trustee, stating that the trustee's authority and the conditions that bind the trustee in dealing with the property. And then you have deed in lieu, and that's a deed given to the owner or to the debtor in lieu of foreclosure by the lender of mortgage. So, not market transaction. Okay. Hopefully that's a little helpful as we go into just the few that we have this year of explaining to the taxpayers why we don't use certain sales in our sales pool or don't consider them market transactions.
You didn't consider the deed, the trust deed, as part of your pool, or you did?
No. So it's the same thing before. You could be conveying into a trust.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, why do we do all this? So we do all this to determine what levies need to be. We calculate the levies based upon the value and based upon what the districts need to collect for their budgets. So the levy process has two players. One's the taxpayer, you, me, companies, you name it, property owners, and the taxing districts. So what fire district you're in, what cemetery district, city of Pasco, Pasco school district, county current expense. So that determines what levies you have to pay. And we need to know one piece of data from each player, from the taxpayer, what's the value of their property. And we determine that either through our assessment or through this process. And then we get the budgets from the taxing districts. So every fall, the budget, the districts send us their request, and it states on there a monetary amount they want to collect. And then we do some statutorial tests to make sure that they're under the limitations that they're subject to. Mm-hmm. One you've heard is like the 1%, but there's various limitations. And the process is pretty simple, the basic process. The amount of money needed for the taxing district's budgets is divided by the value of the property in that district. And that gives us a range. And then we apply that rate to the value, and that results in the tax. Then we take those individual district rates and we consolidate them. So if you live in four or five different districts, say you live in City of Connell, North Franklin School District, Cemetery District, the Library District, the County Current Expense, then we would take all those levies and we would form a consolidated levy and apply it to your value, and then that results in the tax. And that process usually starts in December. We work with the treasurer. We calculate the levies in our office, and then we roll to the treasurer, and she prints the tax statements and sends them out. We work very closely with them during that time. I would say I worked with the levy guru for the state of Washington. Steve put together some very great tools just really set it up nice for our county, and has done presentations and examples to other counties on the levy process. Our process is audited every year by the state of Washington, Department of Revenue. So they go through and they'll say they can do findings or actions, those kinds of things. You know, they look at how we calculated the limits or those kinds of things. And they'll make suggestions or they'll say, you know, you have to do this. And then the next year they'll follow up with us. After these findings, how did you do? How did you handle that? So we had the opportunity last week to have a workshop with all the districts in the county and go over the budgetary process and the resolution they submit to us, how it works, those kinds of things. And I thought it was very well received and asked a lot of good questions. And we had good participation. We had all three commissioners here. We had about 30 people show up. So I thought it was very, very beneficial for people to connect the dots. One of the challenges being assessor is to translate things into people they disassociate between that vote at the booth and a resulting tax, or how the levy process works. How come my value goes, like last year, everybody's value went up, but most people's taxes went down in our county.
That's right.
Because of the result of legislation, not because of the levy process. I mean, it's part of the levy process, but it was changes to that process that forced that. That was great being my first year. Not going to get so lucky next year. There are changes coming forward that we'll talk about, a little bit about. You know, the levy process and legislation is always changing. So just a quick example. So we have the change in value from year to year. The district budget stays the same. So one of our two variables is constant. If you look at that, the value goes up, the district budget stays the same. What happens to the levy rate? Levy rate goes down. In 2019, if it goes up again, and the district's budget goes up 1%, so they got an extra $25,000 because they asked for the 1% increase they could get, the levy rate still went down. So that's the beauty of a budget-based system as compared to a rate-based system, which I would like to get into, but I'm not going to. But they're one of the changes this year is on, as you know from last year, we had a pretty dramatic change in the way state school funding was done. The state school part one, they set it at a levy from $1.80. They raised that to $2.70 2 years ago. And last year they got so many phone calls, they said, okay, we're going to give a one-time reduction in 19 of 30 cents on state school part one. And then it's coming on next year. So that will be in 2020. So right there, that's a rate-based increase of 30 cents. So if you look at 29,000 parcels, most of them, the values are going up and the rate's going up as well. That's two positives. That's going to equal a positive. You know, so the question is, will the amount of value we've picked up force the levy rate down on the budget-based districts to compensate for that 30 cents? We'll find out. So I hope so.
Be nice.
Who's going to tell all those taxpayers that?
And you know,
start those radio blogs now.
Yeah, there's it's as you know, I mean, just from looking at the valuation side of it, what we do in our office is complex. The levy process is complex as well.
Yeah.
So part of that is an education process, not only by the appraisers to explain value, but on the administrative staff and myself to try and convey that information as well. So I did want to let you know a little bit about a couple pieces of legislation that happened this last year. that were, one bill that the Assessors Association has been working on a long time has been the senior exemption bill. So in the state of Washington, there's an exemption based upon age and income to provide relief to seniors. The age is 62, and it's based upon any and all income for the household, and it has to be the senior's primary residence. So it's based, it is intended to keep seniors, give seniors property tax relief who are in the lower income levels, to give them a way to mitigate that burden of their property taxes. So in prior years, it was based upon a set, there are three different categories that are income limits that were set by the legislature, and they were $30,000, $35,000, $40,000, and that determined your level of exemption. The lower your income, the better your exemption. The only problem that was happening was $30,000 in King County or Pierce County or Snohomish County is completely different, a different income amount compared to an Eastside County, say Lincoln County or Adams County. The cost of living is drastically different and incomes are different. So what the legislature did was they tied it to a percentage of median income of the counties. And they, which did two things. That will adjust on a systematic basis, I believe, every 4 years now going forward. But it also took it out from being a political football. So if it's an election year and we all want to get reelected, then we increase the income limit and boy, oh boy, you know, everything's good. Well, this kind of took that out of it and said, okay, this is going to be systematic based upon this, and it's going to go forward without us tinkering with it, which I think was very good. Now, the results were Franklin County was one of the few Eastside counties that did have an adjustment in our income levels. So the best level, $30,681. Now, it doesn't sound a lot, but we've had people, if you're $1 over, you don't qualify. So, I mean, we've had people that, you know, they're over by $125. That's tough.
Yeah.
The middle income limit went from $35,000 to $37,498, so $2,500 or $200 a month. And then the upper limit went to $44,316, which is about a 10% increase over. And then if you, like in King County, their upper limit went to $58,000. So it increased quite a bit over there. But if you think about their housing costs and their cost of living over there, if they're under the same income constrictions as seniors in our county, that is probably more equitable.
Right.
So I think it did some good things there. And the assessors I know were glad it passed. It's amazing how much it takes to get a piece of legislation passed. You know, it's quite the process. The other one that we're going to be dealing with going forward, more on the treasurer side than the other side, is called the graduated REIT bill. So REIT is real estate tax affidavits or real estate excise tax. So as you probably know, every time you sell a piece of real estate, you pay excise tax. Mm-hmm. Right now in the state of Washington, it's 1.28%. Now, with this bill, the amount that you pay percentage-wise changes with value. So, and I'll just read it to you real quick. So, beginning in January 1st of 2020, except as provided in this subsection, the rate in tax imposed under this section is follows. So, it's talking about excise tax. 1.1% of the portion of the selling price that is less than or equal to $500,000. So it's talking about that specific value range we'll pay on 1.1%. 1.28%, which is the current rate, of the portion of the selling price that is greater than $500,000 and or equal to less than $1,500,000. So the first 500 grand is going to get taxed at 1.1. The next million is going to get taxed at 1.28. And then 2.75% of the portion of the selling price that is greater than $1,500,000 and equal to or lesser than $3 million. And then 3% for anything over $3 million. So, then they threw the other part of the curveball to the whole thing was the sale of property that is in classified as timberland or agricultural land is subject to the imposed tax under the section at a rate of 1.28% of the selling price. So if the property is in current use, it is taxed at 1.28% for the total sales price. So then there's questions that are coming out. Who determines? You could have multiple properties in a sale. Some are in current use, some are not. The tax is based upon the predominant use. So then there's a process to figure out what the predominant use is. So we're working through that, and there's questions, that people are coming up with. People are already trying to figure out how they're going to work the system.
Yeah.
So... But if you look at that, the impact on sales over $3 million, that's a big difference in excise tax. You know, that's almost 1.7 additional percent you're going to pay on that. And on big transactions, those are usually the people that are pretty savvy and are looking at those costs and figuring all that out. So anyway, we're working on that with... The treasurer's going to be meeting with them next month and working with our local treasurer to work through that whole process. I don't think it's going to have a huge impact in our county, but we'll see. I think we'll be, most of our transactions, if the property's in current, most of the sales, the property is either in current use or not. So that's been good. Hopefully it continues that way. The other thing about the bill, if you choose not to continue in current use, so you have a property that sells in current use, as the buyer you have to say, yeah, I want to continue into current use. If not, there are implications. So compensating tax is what it's called, and that goes back into the back taxes that should have been paid. So if they don't continue in current use, this does not apply. They would pay on graduated degree. So that's about it on new legislation. I did have some cards for you, just so you have my name and email.
Thank you, sir.
Yep. With this process, all appraisers take ownership and are of their work. But your obligation as the board is to make a separate and independent decision, and that's what we want. We desire that as well. Now, I would say we don't come to the board unless we feel we're where we need to be. Sometimes you've been in these hearings, there's things that we don't know that we find out through the process, too, which is good as well. So do you have anything for me that you'd like to add?
No, really appreciate what you guys do. Look forward to lots of hearings.
Awesome. So I do have the minutes and proceedings if you three would like to go ahead and sign that for me. And then just an update as far as mileage and travel, I gave you your forms. You sign that. If you have any questions, feel free to ask on that. And then you do have on your agenda listed out, we received the 39 petitions this year. And then as a reminder, residential hearings have the 20 minutes, and then commercial are going to be 30. And we do need to stick to those time frames. There will be a few people calling in as well, for the, definitely for the commercial ones. So a total of the hearings, we have the 17 residential and then the 15 commercial, so a total of 32. We so far have zero withdrawals, five stipulations, and I have two on the agenda, but there was one yesterday afternoon, so the total of three possible stipulations in progress. And then so breaking out each week, we have next week, we have the three parcels that will have hearings. The 10th of October, we have nine scheduled. The 17th, we have the 5, 31st of October, 8, and on the 11th, or excuse me, the 7th of October, which should be our last hearing day, that is the 7th parcel. Yeah, not going.
So you're thinking that
October, or excuse me, November.
November. Yes.
So the two stipulations in progress?
Possibly three right now.
Three, so they would fit, where would they fit in the calendar?
So they have their stipulations form. The assessor's office has sent them to the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. We just are waiting on them to sign them.
Okay.
So they shouldn't be going to a hearing, but unless they reject the stipulation, I can schedule them.
So what date are those two hearings scheduled, do you know?
They're not scheduled.
They're not scheduled.
Okay, well, so those stipulations aren't reflected in the schedule here.
I do believe there was one yesterday. The one I received yesterday afternoon might have been on the but the two for sure weren't on
this
table. Okay. So, and I'll give you a heads up if that last one does.
So these numbers actually could go up one, if that
potentially two if they don't find it, but it sounds like it's pretty definite. It should be in the mail as of right now.
Okay. So they could be added anywhere on those days. Okay.
Yeah. Not a problem. Yeah. Okay. And I'll definitely let you guys know ahead of time too if that changes.
One thing we would like to request from the chair is that with a 20-minute hearing, and I know you go over it at the beginning, but if the appellant is given 15 to 18 minutes to speak, that gives us about two. So if we could, we want our time to present our case.
I understand that happened.
And some people go on and. You know, and the other thing is, too, when we have nine parcels on a day, if we have everybody show up, we're going to have to move those hearings along to keep on schedule. So we'll be brief, but we want our chance to present our case.
You want your day in court?
Yeah. Right. You know, I understand that happened last year. If it's a 20-minute hearing,
yeah,
you should have 10 minutes each, correct?
Mm-hmm. And not only that, it's not only 10 minutes apiece, but when we have rebuttal then too.
Yeah.
Okay.
You might think
so 8 minutes.
How many questions are going to come along
20,
here?
My understanding on the 20, it's the 5 minutes for the taxpayer, five minutes for the assessor's office, and then the 10-minute rebuttal.
We can do that 5-5. That works.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do you have a countdown clock that the appellant can see?
Well, when it's recording, it does give you the time length.
That doesn't help you if you don't have a countdown.
Yeah.
Right.
Something that actually you can see the times ticking off so that they have to not.
Or kind of sometimes where you see where the light comes on, you got 2 minutes, and then 1 minute the light goes to the other color. That's not a bad idea. Maybe we can do something like that.
Yeah. All right.
Can we get up?
Sands the hourglass.
Right. Flip it over.
It's Thursday, though, Pete.
five minutes hourglass.
I will, next 2 weeks, I will be, next week I'll be getting educated some more. And then the following week I have a conference that I'm attending to go over some of the stuff with the treasurers.
Excellent.
So if there are any questions valuation-wise. Mrs. Morgan?
Yeah.
If I knew how to do that, we could do that.